Hi everyone, it's Stephen Downs here again with Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care. Today we're going to look at some objections to care theory as we wind down our look at the ethics of care in Module 6. We're just sort of making that transition from 6 to 7, but I want to cover this as part of the loose ends that need to be looked at before we move on specifically to the decisions that we make in analytics and AI. So I don't want to linger a long time on this, so we're going to scoop through a bunch of these objections relatively briskly, although you can look at them in more detail. One of the things that they actually show us is the range and the breadth of discussion that has taken place in the last 30 years or so on care theory. There's been, you know, this burst of creativity in the literature as this new approach has unfolded. And I think it comes out hand in hand with a lot of other moves in philosophy and in ethics generally, and not just there, but also in our understanding of cognition and social development. So I think all of this comes together, and it's all part and parcel of the same kind of movement that's happening in philosophy, happening in society. The objections here are drawn from the wider literature, and especially I've drawn a number almost point for point from the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy. I'm not really happy with how they've actually sketched out these objections, but I'll point to some of my criticisms of the way they're phrased, as well as what I think the responses are. And also, too, the approach of offering objections to care theory actually, as I say here, positions the theory of care as a traditional philosophical theory that demands argumentation and defense. And I don't think that really reflects the basis from which ethics of care theory is drawn. It's not being presented as a theory alongside, shall we say, utilitarianism or contract theory or virtue ethics as another one of these choices that you would argue about. I think the perspective it offers is different, and so just treating it as one more candidate that we argue about is misdirected. And I would make the same comments about, for example, a connectivist approach to learning, which is often positioned as one more theory that you can choose after, say, instructivism or constructivism or whatever, behaviorism. Well, yeah, so just pick your theory and argue for it. No, that's not how it works. All right, so the first objection is based on quote-unquote women's nature. And just for the record, I did a search on Google, an image search for women's nature. And I actually put the link in here because I got a whole pile of images, of which the image I used here is characteristic. And so the criticism is that an ethics of care linked to, quote, women's nature, unquote, is something that calls upon and reinforces gender-based stereotypes. You know, it's a, think of the reference to things like women's intuition or women as having softer, more caring kinds of feelings rather than the rational, objective, hard-edged thinking of men, etc. And even if it's true, Tongan Williams, right, it may still be epistemically, that's a terrible word, it should be epistemologically, ethically and prudently imprudent, or sorry, and politically imprudent to associate women with the value of care. And this is the sort of argument, you know, that's based on how your opponents perceive you. You know, socialists hear this all the time. You shouldn't argue for full-fledged socialism because the people who oppose socialism will just find this as a caricature way of thinking about socialism. Well, that may be true, but Yeah, the definition of socialism isn't dependent on what opponents of socialism think, and neither should the definition of an ethics of care be defined by what opponents to an ethics of care might think. Another objection is based on under the heading of employment objections and calls us to think of two separate and distinct expression of feelings by people who are in caring or service working occupations between real feelings and inauthentic feelings. And this comes up when the employee is required as part of the duties of the job to force their own feelings into the background. It's kind of a version of the customer is always right. I think there's a point to this in the sense that, you know, it really is not reasonable to ask that the two sets of feelings converge so that your real feelings are the same as your quote-unquote inauthentic feelings. Nonetheless, it's probably true that the best care workers or the best service workers are those who genuinely feel a fondness and an affinity for their customers, even though the circumstances might make it the case that they don't. But I don't see any of this as an objection to an ethics of care particularly. You know, because I don't think there are real and inauthentic feelings. If you have a feeling, you have a feeling. If you are motivated to provide care, you are motivated to provide care. A job responsibility may impose behaviors on you, like fake smiles, but it can't impose feelings on you. So I don't think that we can draw this distinction that this objection is based on. In the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy, it leads off the section on criticisms of care ethics with care ethics as slave morality. Now, this is a concept that was developed originally by Nietzsche, and if you look online for it, you find quite a bit of references to Nietzsche and some really telling quotes, which I thought about putting in here, but I figured I'd leave that as an exercise for you. But the idea is that a people, whatever people, that is oppressed tends to develop a morality that reaffirms subservient traits as values. So, you know, like, you know, getting along, not disturbing authority, not rocking the boat, all of which could be examples of slave morality. And what happens is that the generalization is extended to the effect that any, I won't say virtue, but any practice or any property of the slave owner or the oppressor is interpreted as something negative. So if your oppressor thinks in a logical, rational way, then because they're your oppressor, thinking in a logical, rational way must be wrong. And so we get care ethics. Care ethics then on these grounds are criticized as a type of slave morality, valorizing the oppression of women. Taking the oppression of women as a given and then looking at, okay, what ways of working, what ways of thinking do women actually have, given that they're oppressed, and then advancing those to a higher moral status. Except I don't think it does that. It certainly raises the opinions and the perceptions and the expressions of feeling and the expressed needs of people who are oppressed, and for very good reason. But it doesn't, through that process, assume that a certain set of ethics that characterize the oppressed people's ethics is then a kind of ethics that apply to everyone, simply because it doesn't take any set of ethics as a set of ethics that applies to everyone. The ethics of a situation is in the situation. And so there's no such thing as a slave ethic that is applied on a wider scale here. Carol Gilligan in particular has been criticized for basing her conclusions on faulty studies, and especially on studies of students who study at elite universities, and especially from a Western US-based perspective. I think that's fair in that those are criticisms of the studies. It doesn't follow, though, that those are criticisms of the theory. Yeah, she could be right, even though her empirical data was flawed. And I think the proliferation of work that's followed since Carol Gilligan, or maybe more accurately, before, after, during, and around Carol Gilligan, is evidence of that. So, sure, we can allow that those particular studies are flawed, or at the very least, far too narrow, like, by the way, most of the rest of cognitive psychology. But that doesn't mean that the theory is false. It doesn't offer an argument against the theory. This is one I've seen a lot, as I mentioned on the outset, for connectivism, the not a theory objection. And the way this is typically phrased is that your theory, in this case care ethics, is already covered by this, that, or some other aspect of some previous theory. So, like, your theory talks about autonomy, equality, and justice. Well, autonomy, equality, and justice were already covered by Kant, so your theory isn't really a new theory. But, or here, John Paley writing, Kant's writings provide the care ethicists with everything they require. Except that Kant's ethics is based on a universality principle, as we saw, and an ethics of care very much isn't. And so the way these principles, such as autonomy, equality, and justice, instantiate is going to be different. In Kant, equality, for example, is going to have to be something that can be applied in the same way to every person throughout society, in the past, in the future, whatever. But in an ethics of care, equality is something that is applied differently in each individual circumstance in which it comes up. It's defined differently, it's applied differently, the effects are evaluated differently. So it's not enough simply to say, well, they have the same words in common, so it's the same theory. I think that the ethics of care is very distinct from Kantian ethics, and for that matter, from social contract or utilitarian ethics as well. It's also not a theory in the sense that, theories, properly so-called, are supposed to provide broad, sweeping generalization that explain wide swaths of natural phenomena, and that's not how care ethics works. I mean, we could, if we really wanted to, describe care ethics in a few succinct sentences, and we've done that already, that could be adapted for every situation. But these sentences, so construed, are kind of hollow and empty because we actually really do need to know the scenario. But that's also true of these other theories and why there's a problem with them. Complex phenomena like ethics, or human society, or the weather, aren't easily and flawlessly described by natural law the way simple things are, like rockets, like computer science, like algebra. And so, we shouldn't make the mistake of conflating between the two. Care ethics is also described as parochial, which is to say it applies to one specific group and not to a wider group. Now, how this happens or how this is instantiated is different depending on which theorist you're talking about. But for example, Neil Noddings says that caregivers have their primary obligations to proximate others, that is to say people who are in the immediate environment, over distant others. So your obligation to provide care is most strong regarding the person in the room you're with, and least strong regarding a person who's on the other side of the planet, which is a matter of practical reality. You can do a lot more for the person who's right there in front of you. But critics worry, and I'm quoting here, that this stance privileges elite caregivers by excusing them from attending to significant differences in international standards of living and their causes. And would be true if all of care ethics happens in that specific room where there's a caregiver and there's a care receiver. But that's not what care ethics covers. It does take a broader view. We did look at how care ethics can be applied on a community and on a global basis, and the impact on community, and more importantly, the impact of community on the caregiver, are very important. And so as a result, it's simply not true that caregivers providing care to, you know, elite clients are are freed from or given a pass on their wider obligations simply because of the proximity principle. I think that would have been clear in the outline that I provided, but I wanted to mention that here as well. Care ethics as essentialist. So the criticism here is that care ethics appeals to a, quote, essential nature of woman. And you get that anytime you say something like, all women are such and such. For example, if you said, all women are natural caregivers, then you're speaking about something that is always present and unchangingly present in all women. Now, I don't think care ethics does that. I do think that those sorts of remarks are made, but I don't see those as defining the extent and scope of care ethics. Now, quite fairly, someone might criticize me of, you know, minimizing the impact of feminism and the nature of women in my account of care ethics. And, you know, I possibly stand guilty of that. I'm not sure. I don't think so. I've tried not to. I've tried to very much reflect the roots in feminism for care ethics, and to be clear about the fact that there are some aspects of care ethics that I can't speak to from experience, partially because I'm not a woman, and partially because I haven't been working in a lot of these care environments. And I think if I had an extended stay in a hospital even, my understanding and perhaps attitude toward care might change. Who knows? But I do what I can with the experience that I have. But I think that there is a good understanding of the fact that women differ from each other in many ways. Certainly, we've discussed the ways that the context and circumstances in which women find themselves will differ from one person to the next, because we said explicitly, my capacity to care depends in part on how society interacts with me or how society cares for me. I would argue that, while there may be an essential nature of woman at a DNA level or something like that, the differences between individual women are sweeping and profound. The differences not just physically, but in their experience, their upbringing, their background, their education, etc. And I don't think anyone in care ethics would deny that. If they did, then they would be subject to this objection, and quite rightly. But I don't think they actually do. Care ethics is also argued to be ambiguous, and this is kind of like, you know, this is almost circular. Let me quote this. Because it eschews abstract principles and decisional procedures, care ethics is often accused of being unduly ambiguous and for failing to offer concrete guidance for ethical action. And my reaction to that is, well, yeah, I could be precise but wrong. But if my effort is to be imprecise but right, arguing that I'm imprecise as a criticism ignores the fact that I would be precise but wrong. You see what I mean? There are reasons why you just use abstract principles, and those reasons are not offset by the precision or concrete guidance it could provide from one circumstance to the next, to the next, to the next. And, you know, it's funny. Held, is it Elizabeth Held, I think? Here is noted as spending several chapters refuting claims that care is anti-universalist and cannot serve as an ethical theory. Here, I think she's accepting the objection and saying, no, we are really universalist. And I think that would be a mistake. I would resist the claim that care is universalist and go for making good decisions as opposed to making consistent or rule-based or fully guided or concrete decisions. That would be my take anyways. Here we have an objection. And you know, there's a number of these objections are expressed in the form of feelings this or feelings that. And I want to get out in front of that by saying I don't see ethics of care as being based around a concept or theory of feelings, particularly. It's based on a concept of sentiment, perhaps, but that's distinct. And I'm actually going to talk about that more in the next video when I discuss Hume's theory of sentiment. But it's not, as they say, mere feelings, right? It's not intuitions, hunches, or any of these stereotypical descriptions. I, if pressed, would describe it as instances of recognition. You know, the carer is able to recognize the need on the part of the care receiver, or to recognize the injustice, especially when they speak to the caregiver and express what their need is. You know, so it's not simply that, oh yeah, care ethics is all about compassion and empathy and all of that. No, that's not the case. Now, the more serious thing here is that the concepts, whatever they may be, can be used as justification for great violence. That's a concern. I haven't seen any example of great violence being caused because someone cared too much. But, you know, if your natural inclination to think of caring as something as emotional, non-rational, unrestrained, then you can imagine somebody flying into a range and going, and causing great violence. But that wouldn't be consistent with what my understanding of an ethics of care is, because if the person is inclined to commit violence, then whoever they're committing violence against automatically becomes a care receiver. Not a very good care receiver, you know, it's not the kind of relationship you want with them, but, you know, their relation with that person now has to be considered, and their impact on that person has to be considered. It's not simply that you are outraged by the fact that someone was mistreated and therefore go into this murderous rage. The very fact of going into a murderous rage is going to have a wider impact across society, and an ethics of care would argue that you think about that first before you do any such thing. And we'll find that murderous rages are not justified or not sanctioned by, I think, any interpretation of a care ethics that I can think of. Finally, my own criticism of the ethics of care, and I've alluded to this before, is that it's a view from above. That is to say that the ethics of care is described predominantly from the position of the caregiver. I haven't seen this objection in the literature, although it would not surprise me at all if it is there. Why would I think that I'm, after 30 years, I've come up with a completely unique theory or a completely unique objection to the ethics of care? That would be ridiculous. But I think we can say something like, the needs expressed or otherwise of the cared for might be much more pragmatic than the needs as perceived by and described by the ethics of care. And we see that a lot in actual concrete social situations where the people who are trying to provide social reform and social change and justice and equity and all of that come to a population, an oppressed population, arguably in need of these things, and the oppressed population says something like, whoa, 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 I don't need any of that. I need food on the table, I need job security, and better health care. And you see the dissonance between the caregiver and the care receiver, and the ethics of care, as I've been reading it, always seems to be from the perspective of the caregiver. Now, that might be me misinterpreting it, and if so, put me down then as just the same as all the rest of those objections. And I'm perfectly fine to be found to have been saying that. The other thing here is, it doesn't seem reasonable to require the cared for to, well, I've written here, stimulate urgency or motivation in the caregiver. I mean, yes, it's important for there to be a relationship in order for the caregiver to actually understand or assess what the care receiver's need is. But you can't put a whole lot of onus on the care receiver to be able to articulate that. And you have to be careful about that. It's more like, if they say something, you really need to listen to it. But don't expect that they're going to be able to or going to be in a position to express all of the needs that they actually have. Now, we need to be careful here, because now if I start imposing my view of what their needs are, even though they haven't expressed them, that can be very patronizing, and again, coming from this view from above. So we want to be careful about that. But at the same time, we have to take into account the actual real position of the people who are receiving care and what their perception of the issues are, what their perception of the potential redress is, and begin from that perspective before we start trying to put anything on them, and especially before we start putting an onus on them. I'll give you a really concrete example of this from my own life. And that's the case of Indigenous land claims in Canada. Now, one of, if not the most urgent requirements of reconciliation in Canada for our treatment of Indigenous peoples and the process of colonization can be expressed with the principle, land back. It was their land, give it back, in the words of Midnight Oil, right? How can we sleep when our beds are burning? It belongs to them, let's give it back. So, I'm not sure what that means. I don't think they want my house. I'm pretty sure they don't. If they do, then we probably have a problem. But I don't think they do. But I'm not clear on what they mean by land back. Now, First Nations Indigenous peoples own the land kind of the way the government of Canada owns the land, right? My house is part of Canada. I pay taxes based on laws and principles from the provincial and federal governments. I'm subject to easements. I'm subject to expropriation, etc., right? So it might be my land, But contrary to what some of the sovereign individualists think, my ownership of this land is not independent of the country in which it sits. Now, if land back simply means transferring ownership of that kind of ownership from Canada to Indigenous nations, that makes a bit more sense to me. But now I have a problem of having lived in a democracy, and now I live in something that is not a democracy. And I don't think that's what they're asking for either. But maybe they're asking for all or some of Crown lands. Maybe they're asking for all or some of the royalties from resources on the lands, etc. I could go on, right? But let's not. The point here is, it's not up to the Indigenous people to explain this to me. And the way I've just put it, it really, it's like I should just go to one of them and say, "Well, what do you mean by land back?" Right? But they're not in a position to do that because there's 20 million of me, and far fewer of them. And it takes a lot of explaining. So the obligation on me, the descendant of former colonizers, or more accurately, the descendant of former Irish refugees from English colonization, that's a whole separate issue. The onus is on me to determine as best I can, by talking with them when I can, or listening to them when they speak, and then doing whatever I can in good faith to make good on that requirement of land back. But it's not all on them. And it's not all on the cared for to create this urgency and motivation on the part of the carer. Now, I think care ethics probably respects that. But to the extent that it doesn't, that would be a criticism. Anyhow, that's it for this video. Next up will be a discussion of David Hume and the idea of morality or ethics as a sentiment. And I think there we can begin to make some real progress in bringing together some of the stuff that we've been talking about on ethics and some of the stuff that we've been talking about on analytics and AI in the field of learning, bringing all those together. I'm Stephen Downes. Thanks a lot for listening to me. Aren't you happy it's a half-hour video? Talk to you next time.